Good day, everyone, everywhere, and special greetings to all those seated in heavenly places in Jesus, our Messiah. The name of this broadcast is Cross the Border. I'm Nicholas, and today is a live prophecy reality edition. So come on over to the chat room at firstamendmentradio.com. The studio cam is on, and we're going to discuss a few things. First of all, I think we're going to jump back into the revelation and continue our inquiry into the things which must shortly come to pass. At least if you're time sensitive, back to the end of the first century, they would shortly come to pass as to the commencement of those things. So you want to stick around for that. And I think in the second hour, I don't know, I'm thinking about jumping back into our history of Protestantism. We got some great history. We want to continue that until the very end of it, which should take a couple years maybe. But the history of Protestantism is quite a story. And prophecy and history are the same thing. Of course, prophecy is history written in advance by the Almighty, who saw all things from the beginning to the end, and he wrote some of those key things down for us so that, well, one, to authenticate his word, and basically that's it, so we'd have a clue as to what was going on or what was going to happen in the future, and to give us an assurance that what he wrote was true as we watched prophecy unfold in history. And we have watched prophecy unfold in history. Most people can't see past their own lives. They're not taught true history, and they never learn the correlation. So they fall for future speculations. They believe that speculation is truth, when speculation can only be speculation, and it will ever only be speculation. But history is not speculation. It's verified history, and that's what we're looking for in our prophecy, a prophecy that has been verified in history. Is there any news going on that's noteworthy? Well, we all know that in the last week that perhaps the peace plan that the current president is working on for the Mideast was leaked. And so we can see how all of the actors on the stage are reacting to the leaked peace plan. Not really newsworthy. There's some interesting things, and I don't think I want to go through them all, because until it starts to play out, it's really just like some people say, maybe it's a trial balloon to see what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. But I think the gist of the whole thing is that if the actors who are part of this peace plan, if they don't accept it, they will be warred upon. From Israel to the Palestinians, okay? Doesn't matter who you are. And, of course, it helps if you help develop the peace plan, because then you won't be warred upon, because you're in collusion with it, maybe to a certain degree. But, is everybody going to be happy? I don't know. Is it the best they're going to get? Probably. So they can either continue the way things are, or they can try to make things better. But we'll see. And will it lead to the building of a third temple type structure for national Israel? Well, we'll just have to all live and see, because prophecy doesn't tell us that there will be a third temple built before Jesus returns. But that doesn't mean that they won't attempt to build one, or that something resembling a temple won't be built. Okay? All right. Thank the few people in the chat room. This first segment, if you want to chime in with comments or questions on any other topic before we jump into our apocalyptic inquiry, well, now's the time. And if anyone wants to call in, I got a new number here. Let me put that in the chat room again as soon as I get it up here. I have it handy. It's easy to remember. It's 559-838-9330. That's our new call-in only number, and that's a Skype number. So Something will pop up on my screen, let me know you're present, and it'll put you on the air with me. I'm not using the other phone. The other number is just the studio number for off air. So, okay, and this other one is only for on air. If you call it at other times, it'll answer automatically, and you might hear what's on the air, but you won't be able to go on the air. So that's how that works. Depends on whether I set it to answer automatically or not. And yeah, Skype hasn't made things easier for us broadcasters here to switch things back and forth. But enough of that tech talk. Okay, well, I'll say hi to Chief of Sinners. Well, join that club. You know, Paul said that he was the Chief of Sinners, you know, that's a recognition, really, when Paul was talking about, it's no longer I who sin, but sin that dwelleth in me. It was a recognition that, you know, as much as we might want to be sinless because we love our Master and, you know, we love the Lord Jesus Christ and we want to please Him in everything we do. But there's this recognition, as long as we're walking around in this mortal flesh, that we carry this sin nature that we acquired from Adam, and we need the blood of Christ more as much as anybody else, and nobody can work their way, and nobody's going to deserve, you know, eternal life and the resurrection, because God is not a debtor to any man, and so we're all like the chief of sinners because we can't stop even though we want to. But we can, we may not be able to become sinless. Like a lot of people, I mean, there are sects out there that believe that they can reach sinless perfection. There are people that actually believe they have reached sinless perfection, but just their saying that or claiming it is an observation to the opposite. Okay. Yeah, that's the truth. But we can sin less. And, you know, that's a trajectory that we have in our life as true Reformed, Bible believing Christians, is that we do sin less. We are in the process of being perfected. We are not perfect. We are being perfected. We are not sinless. We are sinning less as our life moves toward the, termination of our mortality. And the introduction of our immortality, when we see Him, we will be like Him. And thank you for that amen, my friend in the chat room. I talked to him, Chief of S. I think that's Chief of Sinners, if I get it. I talked to him on the phone, but I forgot the name of the person I was talking to already. But glad to see you in the chat room anyway. We had a brief but good conversation the other day. Okay, I think we're going to jump into our text then and continue our inquiry into the Revelation. And we got through chapter 5, and we read some commentary from E.B. Eliot on it. 4 and 5 are kind of an introduction. We have the scene, we have the heavenly temple scene, but it's not really, it's an introduction to the one who's worthy to open the book, to show us the things which must be hereafter. So we're going to jump then into chapter 6, if I am correct. And, John continues to write there. And I always like to back up because it seems like we always kind of jump off in the middle of nowhere. Because when we were given the Revelation in all of these books of the Bible, they were written in one. Each one was written in a continuous letter. There were no chapter headings. There probably some kind of paragraph separations or something. But I haven't seen the scrolls or the original Greek transcripts, so I wouldn't know, but I do know that the chapter number and verse numbering system was not in use. And so we end this chapter 5. It says, And the four beasts said, Amen. And the 24 elders fell down and worshipped him that liveth forever and ever. So this is the scene in heaven, or the third heaven, where Yahuwah himself is present. And all of this worship is going on. We talked about that last week. So we begin chapter 6, and John writes, And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, Come to me, or come and see. Okay, I'll get it together here. You got to be kind of in a certain state of mind to be able to read things correctly for a while out of the air. Okay, chapter 6, verse 1 of the Revelation. And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, Come and see. And I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. And so now we're getting into the four horsemen, as they're called, of the apocalypse. And I think we're going to take these one at a time. And before we even do this, before we jump in, I think I'm perusing some of E.B. Eliot's commentary. I just have to go back there, because no one has done such an exhaustive and concise commentary on the Revelation. Everything else pales in comparison. You can throw out all of your futurist expositions of the Revelation, unless you want to laugh or compare them and see what's wrong, you know, unless you want to be informed how not to read the Revelation. But let's jump in, and what I'm going to do is, you can join me on this, is you can go to horiapocalyptike.wordpress.com, and you can put a link in the chat room to exactly where I'm going for those people that are in the chat room. This is where I'm going for the time being. And I'll tell you exactly where I'm at. If you go to horiapocalyptike.wordpress.com, and you go to, you click on Contents, Volume 1 tab there, select that, and you scroll down to Chapter 5 of the introduction, because this is the introduction. Well, there are a lot of it. Is that where I'm at? Oh, on the ensuing historical exposition of the Revelation. So it's Chapter 5 of the introduction part of it. And I wanted to go through that quickly, if that's possible, with you. So if you click on that, it'll take you to that chapter 5 on the ensuing historical exposition of the Revelation. E.B. Eliot says, And now, as the conclusion of this introductory part, it may perhaps be useful to set before the reader a brief general statement of the principles, plan, and, as I hope, evidence of truth that he will find to characterize the following exposition of the apocalyptic prophecy. So he's talking about the things that are to come, the true prophetic part. We covered the things that are, because when Jesus came, you know, the revelation of Christ came, and he spoke to the churches, he was speaking of the things which are, the general condition of the church, with some epistles that would serve all of the following generations, but explicitly to that generation. So we're moving on to the things which shall be hereafter. And remember, this is a prophecy. The entire Revelation is a prophecy to the church. It's not a Jewish prophecy, though Jewish symbols are used, but all of those symbols pertain to that counterpart of the church that Jesus said, I will build. Jesus didn't say, I will build a new, national Israel. He didn't say that. See, the time for national Israel was over. The 70 weeks ended, okay, 3.5 years after the Messiah was crucified and rose again. Okay? And after he ascended to be with the Father, there were still, you know, about 3 years left after he rose and ascended. And he appeared to the church that was in Israel the same way he appears to us today, in spirit and with the Holy Spirit. So he ministered for the most part of the last half of the 70th week of Daniel's 70th week, and the last week for Israel as a nation set apart to God. It doesn't mean the nation ended, because they went on for almost another 40 years until 70 AD before the nation and the temple and the city was completely decimated, abolished, destroyed. Okay? That final judgment came upon that nation as foretold by Daniel and Jesus in the same prophecies. But in the last part of the 70th week, he ministered to the church, because remember he said, I have not come but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So his ministry was only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, because it was the final and 70th week. To the Jew first came the gospel, and then to the world. So when the 70th week ended, we have a supranational Israel. Not a national Israel, a supranational Israel, where people from all nations, every other kindred, every other tongue are now being grafted into this supranational Israel. Okay? And Jesus, as the way he ministers to us now in the Spirit and through his Holy Spirit, is the same way he ministered in the church before the 70th week ended, in that final 3.5 or last 3.5 years of the 70th week. And then the gospel goes to the nations. Okay? So that's where we're at there. And then after that, Jesus said, I will build my church. And he has been building his church ever since. So the appearance now of a national Israel is not part of this prophecy of the Revelation. This prophecy is explicitly to the seven churches, which are in Asia, and of course all of the churches that spring from them, from the witness of those beginning churches. Okay? That doesn't change through the whole thing. As a matter of fact, I was hearing another expositor on First Amendment radio this week. He was talking about the Gog and Magog War of the Revelation. And he was saying, as I understand it, this means that Israel will be back in the land. No, this is supranational Israel during the millennium. So it is the church that Jesus said he will build. Israel is the symbol in the Revelation for the supranational Israel of God. I hope you can see that. I hope that that's understandable. And whether it's acceptable to you or not, doesn't change a thing. That's the way it is. That's what's explicitly given to us in the Revelation, that this is a revelation to the seven churches, and of course to the offspring of those seven churches, which we are of today. Okay. He continues. Its subject matter, I assume, to be the continuous fortunes of the church and of the world. And he says that is of the Roman world and Christian church settled therein. We're still here. It's the continuous fortunes. And that's what he sets about to show us. From the time of the revelation being given, or time of St. John's banishment, to the end of all things. This, its commencing date, I consider, as already observed, to have been fixed by Christ's own words, I will show thee the things that must happen after these things. If the words these things means the state at that time of the apocalyptic churches, as described in the seven epistles, a point which I suppose few will doubt, then must Christ's declaration, as it seems to me distinctly and all but necessarily imply that the foreshowing of the future should begin from the time of John's banishment or soon after. This is indeed admitted by the most competent judges. And the importance of this canon of historical exposition of the apocalypse, thus fixed, cannot be overestimated. It sets aside of itself what there is indeed, as I think, superabundant other evidence also to set aside. And he goes on to say, it sets aside the futurist interpretation, which overleaps the entire historical chasm between the first century and now the 21st century, okay, and places the entire, says it sets that aside, the plain reading of the text, a simple understanding, as we've been speaking of here. In the divine foreshowing of its great subject, I have felt persuaded and carried out my exposition on the persuasion that the two following rules must have been observed. First, that the epochs and events selected for prefiguration must have been such as are confessedly the most important and eventful. Secondly, that the figuring emblems must have been in some approved consistent sense characteristic and distinctive, such as would be the case were a mastermind among men to develop the great general subject in a series of descriptive sketches or pictures. How then can we suppose it otherwise in the prefiguration of the omniscient spirit? The direct evidence of truth hence arising in case of agreement between the symbolical and historical object it is applied to will at once be felt by the intelligent reader. And I could go on. I mean, you should read all of this yourself. If you're really interested in prophecy, go to horreapocalyptica.wordpress.com and read the entire thing. Now, I'm on my, this is like my fourth or fifth reading of this. And I tell you what, it's beginning to make sense. My first readings, not so much, I have to admit. The more I read it, the more I understand it, and the more plain it becomes. It was like the first time I opened up the book of Proverbs in the Bible. It was like reading another language. It was English. It was the King James Version in English, but it didn't make any sense to me. But now, you know, after I've read it, I don't know how many times, but many more than I've counted. I open it up and it makes perfect sense to me. It's almost simple, but complex and profound at the same time. What can I say? And the same thing with reading, E.B. Eliot's Horae Apocalypticae. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to close that tab and I'm going to jump to part one, the first six seals. And we'll pick up the introduction on the first six seals when we return from some messages. You're listening to Cross the Border, a Prophecy Reality edition, and we're continuing our expose or our what am I calling it? I'll remember that when I get back. The Book of Revelation. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust, I will not be afraid. Behold, God is my strength.
Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe, so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back. You're listening Across the Border, a Prophecy Reality Edition, and we're continuing our inquiry into the Apocalypse, the Book of Revelation, and we're looking at Chapter 6. Chief in the chat room asked me a question there, and I think that's going to take us too far from where we're at in the Scripture today, so I'm going to give you a homework assignment. You tell me why or why not. Yeah. And then next week we can talk about it in the first segment if you would like to. But yeah, why or why not Jerusalem? Okay. I guess you have to be in the chat room to understand that one. But we're going to jump back into, our book here, because I was just getting ready to open up chapter 6 and we had read down to where, the first seal was open. Okay. And chapter 6, verse 2, and I saw and behold a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. What does the symbol mean? Where do we find it in history? And how do we know? I mean, it seems like we're given very little to go on, so what we're given must be very succinct. And it must be evident in history somehow as to what this white horse and him that sat on him, having a bow and a crown given to him and going forth conquering and to conquer. What does it mean? What do all of these clues mean in prophecy, and where have they been fulfilled in history? Because this is the opening scene of the things which must shortly come to pass. So certainly in 2,000 years, it's begun, okay? And this would be one of the first things that we would see on the ground. So we're going to look very early in history for it. At least that would be what I would think by what I've learned so far, okay? Stay away from that futurist stuff. And I think E.B. Elliott has the best explanation. So once again, you know, I have to turn to E.B. Elliott, and I'm going to let's see, volume one, tab there, scroll down to where it says part one, the first six seals. And you could read the introduction and maybe we'll look at that a little bit later or something. But let's look at the first seal to see if we want to continue this and see if this guy really has a clue. Okay. And what then was to be characteristic of the state of the Roman Empire, according to the first seal's prefiguration following, after the time then present of the apostles' exile at Patmos? It might not unhappily have been expected by Christians who, like him, were suffering from Domitian's persecution that it would not be very long before, under the sentence of God's righteous judgment, the great persecuting empire of heathen Rome would be seen declining towards its dissolution. And truly the vices, follies, and oppression of the emperor then reigning, just as of most that had preceded him, might suggest an internal cause then already in operation. And moreover, the recent successful incursions of the frontier barbarians, an external one, each apparently most sufficient of itself to produce that result. But such a result was not indicated to St. John. On the contrary, the first symbol under which the Roman people was represented, as I am presuming, to his view, represented it somewhat strangely under the color of triumph, prosperity, and health in the body politic. I looked, and lo, a white horse, and he that sat thereon, having a bow and a crown, was given him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. Combining the chief indications here given, it was as if prosperity long unknown would spring up and continue for some considerable time within the empire, a prosperity introduced in some striking manner by wars of victory. And that would be still attended by victory, whenever and wherever wars might arise afterwards, even to the end of the period prefigured, to which wars there would be a going forth under guidance, answering to that of the crowned bow-bearing rider, thereby assuring the general inviolability from foreign foes, and perhaps, for the words might seem to intimate as much, advancing the limits of the greatest of the greatness of the empire. And at first, did not this answer very notably and distinctly to the general state in history of the Roman Empire for the 80 or 90 years succeeding John's banishment? That is, from Domitian's death, AD 96, throughout the successive reigns of Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, and the two Antonines, until the ascension of Commodus and triumphant peace made by him with the Germans, AD 180, or indeed, yet a year or two farther on, to the completion of his Germanic successes, and coincident primarily deterioration of his government in 183 or 184. I turn to Gibbon, whose history, by a singular coincidence in respect of commencing date as well as of subject, agrees with the apocalyptic prefiguration, and find him, just as in this first seal's symbolic sketch, deferring for a while to enter on this on his great subject of the decline of the Roman Empire, in order in the first place to describe its glory and its happiness in this precise era, as being that which immediately preceded its declining. In fact, he makes it the bright ground, if I may say so, of his historic picture, whereon to trace out afterwards more effectively in dark coloring the successive traits of the empire's corruption and decline. He represents it, and his representations are well confirmed by the original histories remaining to us, as a golden age of prosperity, union, civil liberty, and good government, a period unstained with civil blood, like the white of the first apocalyptic horse, in contrast with the red of the second, and undisturbed by revolution. That's a quote from, these are quotes from Gibbon. Golden Age, unstained with civil blood, undisturbed by revolution, a period remarkable both at its commencement and at its close for very wonderful and almost uniform triumphs in war, whereby the glory of the empire was illustrated and its limits extended, and of which the middle interval, though not without occasional wars, always successful on the frontiers, was generally timed of profound and happy peace. In short, he thus sums up his view of it. If a man were called to fix the period in the history of the world, this is a quote, if a man were called to fix the history of the period of the world, during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would, without hesitation, name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the ascension of Commodus. E.B. Eliot continues, I said that the wars of the Romans during this period were all but uniformly triumphant, and it may be well briefly to particularize on this point, not to rest then on Nerva primary Pannonian triumph, which instantly, as the new era opened, served to mark the return of victory under it to the Roman banners. I say not to rest on this. Who knows not of the triumphs under Trajan, the Roman Alexander, by which Dacia, Armenia, Mesopotamia, and other provinces were in the course of the first 20 years of the period I ask of added to the Roman Empire, as regards the 43 years which followed, constituting the reigns of Hadrian and Antoninus Pius, though they were years for the most part of honorable and glorious peace, yet there were passing wars in each reign sufficient to illustrate the continued fulfillment of the predicted destiny that they should conquer. And are you getting the idea? I mean, if you go through the Horae Apocalypticae, there's more. I mean, we're covering about a hundred year period here with this white horse going forth to conquer and to conquer and conquering. Okay. And so covering 100 years. So he can go through it. The Jewish wars. He goes first the Jewish war under Hadrian. Let's see. I'm going to just go through these quickly. And he continues listing till the German barbarians driven to their forests. So you can see the barbarians that finally conquered the empire. What, 400 years later, when the Roman Empire was divided into the ten horns, as we all know about under the Revelation. But the Germans were early pounding on the Roman Empire. So it didn't happen instantly. So they had this period where the Roman Empire was going forth to conquer and conquering, and it was general peace within the Roman Empire. So it was an era of, well, you know, like what presidents of the United States would like to brag about right now. Yes. Two, the empire's triumphs and prosperity during the subject era, whence the influential agency that would cause these. In other words, who the agents personified by the writer, that which is related of the reigning emperors throughout this era, their absolute authority. For under them, says Gibbon, the Roman Empire was governed by absolute power under the guidance of virtue and wisdom, the armies being restrained by the firm and gentle hand of four successive emperors, and their power used only to cherish the nation's happiness, advance its prosperity, or guide it to its triumphs, must at once have suggested them as the person symbolized. As Gibbon continues, the delight was theirs of beholding the general happiness of which they were the authors. And I could go on and on. Let's see. There were some other key points. He talks about the bow. One objection, however, may still present itself. One difficulty seemed to stand in the way of this, our imperial application to the prophetic symbol. I mean the fact of the rider having a bow in his hand. Yeah. See, all of these symbols must mean something. And if they don't point to what we're pointing to, if we can say, well, this doesn't mean that, then we have a good objection to our interpretation. Okay. So he's no stone unturned here with E.B. Eliot on the history to which he marks these symbols, which. So he says, I mean the fact of the rider having a bow in hand, for the weapon represented in the hands of Roman emperors on medals and other extant monuments of antiquity is generally the javelin, sometimes a sword, never, so far as I know, the bow. And hence, indeed, Vitringa, though not unconscious of the general fitness of the emblem of a crowned rider on a white horse going forth to conquer, conquering and to conquer, to depict the era of prosperity and triumph under the five Roman emperors whose reigns followed after the date of the apocalyptic visions, yet argues that the bow was an Asiatic or barbarian weapon and badge and purposely inserted in the hieroglyphic to divert the thoughts of the observer from the Roman Empire. So we have Vitringa, another expositor on the Revelation, saying not so. The bow says it can't be the Roman Empire. Okay? What's E.B. Eliot's answer to this? He says, but is this correct? Was the bow a badge of Asiatic and other barbarians only? Was there not one particular province and people among the provincials of the Roman Empire of whom it was also distinctive? Distinctive, not equally alone, but almost even more than any barbarian people whatsoever? If the reader will consult the records of antiquity, he will find, if I mistake not, that such indeed was the case with the island and islanders of Crete, alike in their colonial origin, mythological tradition, legends, military history, and manufacture attest this peculiar connection of the Cretans and the bow. As to their origin, it appears from ancient authors that Crete was originally peopled, in part at least, from the part of Palestine situation on the Mediterranean coast, which was by the Arabs called Caritha and the Syrians Creth, its inhabitants bearing a similar Hebraic appellation, Cretham, as the 70 have translated it in the Hebrew or in the Greek, and that is, I guess he's talking about the Septuagint, respecting which Cretham, Bocart adds that they were noted archers, some of them employed by David as his lifeguard. It is Sir Isaac Newton's supposition that Crete was thus peopled from Palestine about 1045 BC, when many of the Phoenicians and Syrians fled from King David into Asia Minor, Crete, Greece, Libya. Others date the migration earlier, but whatever the epoch, of this is certain, that in Crete itself, the archery habits of the Syrian Cretham colonists, as well as their name, remain. The earliest traditional legends of the Cretan islanders ascribe a similar preeminence in the art of those, their forefathers who were in the island native born. It is told to us by Diodorus Siculus that Apollo, the Cretan Apollo, was affirmed in these legends to have been the first inventor of the bow, and how he taught the natives archery, whence their superior skill in the art, before and above all other men. Memorial Cretan medals, of which tradition are still extant, struck in the Roman imperial times, some bearing the device of Apollo and his bow, some of Diana and her bow, with the inscription, and he has some Greek there, descending from the times of legendary fable to those of real history, we find the connection of the bow and the Cretan islanders constantly marked thenceforward for ages in the military annals of the neighboring states. Among Homer's hero was the Cretan Marion, who bore away the palm in archery. By Pindar, the appellation bowman is attached as distinctive appellation of Cretan islanders. And Pausanias states that in those earlier times, the Cretan alone, of all the Greeks, were archers, impugning the correctness of a piece of sculpture which represented Diotrephes as pierced by arrows, his slayers being other Greeks, not Cretans, with reference to later times. And we're getting really bogged down here with a lot of historic details to make the point. And so I'm going to kind of go up here and move on. But what the appellation of all this, the reader may be thinking, to the point at hand. Yes, exactly what I was thinking. Or how the sense that we have inferred to attach the emblem of a bow to connect itself with the hieroglyphic of the first seal and its imperial horseman riding it to triumph. I now proceed to show this, finally. We had to skip quite a few paragraphs to get to this point here, but a lot of good detail if you're really into it. If you want to read the whole thing, it's very persuasive, more persuasive than anything else if you want arguments in favor of a historical interpretation, if they're really needed, okay? So he says, or how the sense that we have inferred to attach the emblem bow to connect itself with the hieroglyphic of the first seal and its imperial horseman riding to triumph, I now proceed to show this. It is well known that down to the ascension of Otho, the reigning Caesars, from Julius to Galba inclusive, were of old Roman families, agreeably with the Roman jus imaginium. They exhibited in each of their halls the busts of long time of Roman nobles, their ancestors, whether of the Julian gens, the Claudian, or the Sulpician, and as for Otho, Vitellus, Vespasian, or Vespasian's two sons, Titus and Domitian, if not all of Roman, yet they were of Italian extraction, and indeed Otho of an Italian family, still more ancient and noble than all the rest, for he was descended from the Etruscan kings. But after Domitian, there was a notable change on this head in the character of the imperial succession. It is said to have been pre-intimated in a dream a little before his death to Domitian. He dreamed, says Suetonius, that a neck of gold appeared to grow branching off from his own neck behind, to which so branched off, implying a new line of emperors, and that the gold their characters introduced the golden age. Another historian, Aurelius Victor, expressly sets forth the novel character of this line as a fact very remarkable in respect of its being one of princes of foreign extraction. Hitherto, men of Roman or Italian origin ruled the empire, and from that time, foreigner is an extraction, in which statement he is followed, indeed, copied by the younger Victor, and they both note at the same time the increased happiness that accrued to the empire from the innovation. And what then, the foreign country or province to which the five emperors might be ascribed as to lineage and family that followed next after Domitian? And introduced and kept up this golden age of the empire? Prior to which question, another must indeed first be answered. Can they be all classed together under one and the same head and family? The answer to which latter question is that they may be so classed together, because in manner quite unparalleled in the subsequent history of the Roman emperors, they were all connected as in the line of one and the same family by successive adoptions. Let me guess. We continue. Trajan was adopted by Nerva, Hadrian by Trajan, Antoninus by Hadrian, Aurelius by Antoninus. Each in their medals and other extant memorials of antiquity illustrate to us, taking the name of his predecessor in virtue of the adoption. Thus, according to the well-defined Roman law of adoption, were all reckoned as of Nerva's family, he being the head of the line. And what was Nerva's own national origin and extraction? In Dion Cassius, we find what is evidently an allusion to him, and Italiate, which word will, by a reader versed in Greek language, be well understood to mean a colonist of Greek extraction, settled in Italy. His exact Greek provincial origin, however, he does not mention, but Aurelius Victor supplies the omission. He tells us, and most of our best known modern historians of the earlier emperors of Rome repeat the statement, that Nerva was, in respect of family extraction, a Cretan. Yes, the meaning of the bow in the writer's hand is now indeed manifest. And how admirable beyond what was the most learned of human artists or scholars would have devised appears the point and the comprehensiveness of this device of the divine spirit. Had a javelin, a sword, been in the hand of the writer, so as Vitringa would have had it, in case of his representative Roman empires, the weapon carried would have added precisely nothing either to the meaning or the distinctiveness of the hieroglyphic or symbol. The crown sufficing to designate emperors, and the javelin and sword, although appropriate, but not being distinctive of them. And so, I think we'll end that there. There's a lot more if you want to read a continuation of the, we're getting now down to the end of it. And you can see what pains E.B. Eliot went to establish in history. And all the footnotes are there. You can follow them all through. E.B. Eliot did not fake any footnotes or misrepresent anything if you want to check them out, like all of the futurists do today. And others who, we've discussed that before, taking footnotes out of context or just faking them all together or ascribing them to a topic that they don't even fit to. But no, not so with E.B. Eliot. You can follow all of these histories. He gives all of the names, all of the historians, and you can look them up yourselves. But now you understand why he has a bow in the hand of the white horse. The rider and the white horse. And when we get back, we'll jump in. We'll take a look at the second horse of the apocalyptic vision. You listen Across the Border, our prophecy reality edition. We'll be back in a few minutes. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're listening Across the Border, our Prophecy Reality Edition, and we're continuing our inquiry into the apocalypse, and we're at Revelation chapter 6, and we just finished with verse 2 about the white horse, the bow, the crown, the horse being white, and conquering and to conquer, going forth conquering and to conquer. We covered all of that, and we see that the symbols and all of the emblems of that verse point to that first era opening upon the revelation. And we move on now to the next era of the Roman Empire. And when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, "Come and see." And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. And when he had opened the third seal, so that's the second one. And we're going to stick with that one, verses 3 and 4. The red horse. What do these symbols mean? And can we pinpoint, do these point to the next era? Well, the answer, of course, is yes. These are successive eras in the Roman Empire at the opening of the apocalypse, of the things which must, as the apocalyptic scripture says, which must shortly come to pass. And we should add as to their commencement. They would commence immediately, shortly come to pass as to their commencement. But they couldn't all happen at the same time. So this is an unfolding history, or prophecy unfolding in history. So let's look at the symbols with our good friend E.B. Elliott. And as I told you before, we are at horiapocalyptike.wordpress.com. And we're going to move on to, let's see, we just covered chapter 1. Okay, if you go to contents of volume 1, part 1, the first six seals, and now we're moving on to chapter 2. Okay, because that has to do with each successive seal. So chapter 2 is the second horse. And the second seal is opened, and behold, on the second living creature's voice, like thunder, the white horse has passed from view. That symbol of the Roman nation in joyous prosperity and triumph. And another, a red horse, passes over the scene before the eyes of the evangelist, depicting it under the different color of war and bloodshed. But what the kind of bloodshed? The explanatory words that were added defined it to be that of civil war. There went forth another horse, red, and to him who sat thereon it was given to take peace. Okay, not going forth to conquer and conquering. Excuse me. But to take peace. The peace left by the former seal from the Roman earth, and that they should kill one another. And who's the causal agency of the matter? It was indicated to be those whose fitting and distinctive badge was the sword bearing, and there was given unto him, the rider, a great sword. We ask then, was there any strongly marked new era of change accordant with this figuration in the history of the Roman Empire, following next after the era of the first seal, and through a causal agency? And through such causal agency, these are on this lead our two points of inquiry. One, as to the former, let us turn, as before, to Gibbon for the answer. And on consulting his pages, we find the bright period above described, a period including, as we have seen, the triumphant peace made with the Germans after Aurelius's death by his son Commodus, and the first few years of Commodus's reign following, in which he governed well while acting, as by a kind of tradition, on his father's principles and arrangements. We find this period, I say, following in this narrative by what? Just by the breaking up of the state of national prosperity and peace, correspondence with our prophetic figuring, through the evil, not of foreign invasion, but of civil wars, revolution and bloodshed, and evil begun to be prepared immediately after 185, as we shall presently see, by the maladministration of Commodus, and which outbroke in violence AD 193 on the assassination of that emperor, from which epoch it still continued with scarce more than two intervals of intermission, some 80 or 90 years onward, even until the accession of Diocletian, having, however, in the course of this long period, been joined and aggravated by certain fresh evils, internal and external, at two well-defined intervening epochs, of which aggravations more in my two next ensuing chapters, as being the subjects of the third and fourth seals, respectively. It may be well to glance in rapid view at the detail for the first 50 or 60 years at least after his death, of these civil wars and mutual attendant slaughters, the immediate sequel of then of Commodus's assassination just mentioned, was the elevation of Pertinax to the imperial throne. And within a month or two after his murder, then the setting up of Julian as his successor, and the civil wars consequent, prolonged for 4 years and ranging from east to west over the extent of the empire, through which the elder Severus fought his way to the throne, a throne established on the defeat and slaughter successively of the three rival emperors, Julian, Niger, and Albinus. Next, after an interval of repose throughout the remainder of Severus's reign, wherein, however, although the wounds of civil war appeared healed, yet its mortal poison still lurked in the vitals of the constitution. And indeed, by Severus's aggrandizement of the causal agencies of the evil, of which more presently, a preparation was made for all its subsequent aggravation. Next after this, I say, followed the murder of his one son and successor, Geta, by the other, Caracalla, and soon after, though not till Caracalla had introduced into the empire the principle of the added evil, as we shall see hereafter, of the third seal, that of the latter by Macrinus in the camp of Carrhae by the Euphrates, then, and in consequence, the civil war which crushed Macrinus and raised Elagabalus to the throne, then Abagallus's assassination at Rome, then, after a second interval, a partial but partial repose during the 13 years of the reign of his successor, the second Severus, the murder of that well-intended prince in the camp by the Rhine, then the evil wars raised against his murderer and successor Maximin, wherein these two emperors of a day, the Gordians, father and son, perished in Africa, and Maximin himself and his son fell by assassination in the siege of Aquileia. Then the murder at Rome of the two joint emperors, Maximus and Balbinus, next set up by the Senate, and quickly thereafter that of their associate in the empire, the third and youngest, Gordian, on the banks of a river, and other and holier associations, the river Chaboris, then the slaughter of the next emperor, Philip, the last that I shall particularize, together with his son, an associate in the empire, in a battle near Verona, which in the year A.D. 249, as above mentioned, decided the civil war between himself and Decius. Can the history of any empire on record present in any other sexagenarian period such an exemplification of what the apocalyptic prophecy before us prefigured, peace being taken from the empire and men in it killing one another? That is, peace being taken from the empire. Oh, I just read that. Much more would the case seem unparalleled were we, like Sismondi, to trace the evil some 20 or 30 years yet further forward, after it had been conjoined and aggravated by the fresh evil of wars of foreign invading foes, a subject which belongs, however, more properly to our fourth seal. It may suffice here to give, in brief, his more extended summary. Says he, with Commodus's death, commenced the third and most calamitous period. It lasted 90 years, from 192 to 284. During that time, 32 emperors and 27 pretenders to the empire alternately hurled each other from the throne by incessant civil warfare. 92 years of nearly incessant civil warfare taught the world on what a frail foundation the virtue of the Antonines had reared the felicity of the empire. Okay, he says, what next? The causal agency. And in general, the apocalyptic symbol seemed to designate it as the military, the rider of the red horse having, it is said, the great sword given to him, for the sword was natural, a nearly universal in St. John's time, well-recognized and distinctive badge among the Romans of the military profession, while its strange and unnaturally large size in the apocalyptic figure vindicated further an undue authority given unto it. An undue and unnatural use made of it, precisely accord with it, which appears the fact on the very surface of history as to the origin of the sad events we speak of, the causal agent of the civil insurrections and blood shed being, as Sismondi and other state, from first to last, military men in power. Those whose vocation was war, whose weapon was a sword, and whose by the sword rose and by the sword fell. The manner in which, throughout the favored period of our first seal, the license of the soldiery was restrained, and its mighty power kept in subordination to the magistrate, and used only in defense of the country and of order, is one of the chief topics of praise attaching to the great emperors of the second century. Then the law was supreme, and the sword of the army its enforcer, the civil magistracy sustained in their functions, the Senate's high authority recognized, and as regards the imperial dignity itself, the choice left with the Senate, the approval only with the armies. But with Commodus began the fatal change. It may be first dated from the epoch of his exalting Perennis, commander of the Praetorian Guards, and then Oleander, his successor to despotic authority at Rome and in the state, not without military insurrection, civil strife, and bloodshed, even then as its accompaniments. And we're kind of getting the idea. And E.B. Eliot can go on to give you more confirmation. More confirmation of his attaching the symbols to this era of the history of the Roman Empire. Okay? Let's see if we can get a wrap-up of here. Maybe in a state of things like this, it was to be expected, of course, that it would be for the most part the commander of one or another army that would put forward as a candidate for the imperial office. So what he was saying is that commanders or generals of the imperial office of the army of the Roman Empire were put forth to rule the nation, and they ruled by what measure they knew, and that is using the sword internally in their own empire. And well, we have plenty of modern examples of how that works out in history. You can go back to Stalin or Pol Pot or anyone else who used the sword to rule their empire and make the state a complete and despotic governor over the people, using the sword to quiet any commotion that went against their rule. Yeah. So that's what we're looking at. We're looking at a Stalin-type period in this period of history. And so it accords with the symbol given in the apocalyptic prophecy. So we'll move on from there to the next horseman of the apocalyptic prophecy. So we move on. That was the red horse. Verse 5, and when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, come and see. And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine. So we move on to the third horse. The black horse. What does it mean with a pair of balances in his hand? And, the futurists say, well, this is going to be in the last 3.5 years of time or somewhere in the last 7 years. When the Antichrist rises, there's going to be famine covering the earth. And they're going to be measuring out your daily bread by whatever, you know, all this. But let's see what E.B. Elliott, how he points to the next era in the Roman Empire. And I think you may be convinced, at least I am, because I got kind of went back and forth on this for a while. I mean, well, this is what I was taught. This was famine. But maybe not so. Let's jump over here. And now I'm going to go to chapter 3. The third seal. And when he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, come, and I beheld a black horse, we just read that, and hurt not the oil and the wine. The intent of the figuration of the seal is less obvious than the two former, and will require some considerate thought and attention. Through the change of the horse's color to black, can scarce be mistaken as indicating generally the change to a state of aggravated distress and mourning. Let us therefore first consider the usually received, but as will appear, incorrect solution. Then, second, apply ourselves to seek one more correct and satisfactory. 1. A famine. Of the chief articles of food, whether literally taken or metaphorically, has been supposed by nearly all interpreters to be applied in the other details of the poetic passage, as the cause of the distress indicated. Their opinion being grounded on these two suppositions. First, that the koinex spoken of was the common Attic koinex. Second, that the specified prices for a measure of wheat and a barley were famine prices. Nor as to the former of these suppositions do I contest its reasonableness, for although not to dwell on the fact that the word koinex is sometimes used to designate measure in the general. It's actually where we get the word coin from. Koinex. It's a measure. It's a measure of money. A coin. So it's the word koinex is a measure. Okay? Which generic sense, however, from the specific specifications of price given, is here, of course, quite out of the question. Though I say without doubt that there were used in the Roman Empire koinexes of various specific values. That is, as of learned men lay down, of 3, 6, and 8, as well as 4 koitalei, or half pints, respectively, yet was the Attic koinex of 4 koitalei, or 1 quart, so much the most common that, without direct countervalence evidence, we would seem bound to take it as the one intended. And we'll pick up here, right here, after we get back from some messages. You're listening to Across the Border, our Prophecy Reality Edition.
Souls, they also desire to win the fight.
Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
Visit CrossTheBorder.org, C-R-O-S-S, CrossTheBorder.org, to get your print, EPUB, or PDF version of the book, The Rapture Will Be Canceled. That's CrossTheBorder.org.
I know you all want answers, and believe me, so do I, and I'll do my best to get them.
Despite Nicolas Cage's promise to do his best to get Left Behind Rapture answers for us, don't hold your breath. Not everyone believes Left Behind is true prophecy. Some may even regard as conspiratorial the mainstream re-release of the Left Behind movie with actor Nicolas Cage portraying the main character as an attempt to further reinforce in the minds of all this perception of false prophecy in order to condition the masses for the play about to begin. If you want true Bible prophecy answers, get the book, The Rapture Will Be Canceled. The author exposes the Latin rapture origin, the seven-year tribulation deception, true Bible revelation of Daniel's 70 weeks, the abomination of desolation, the restrainer, America in the revelation, the image of the beast, and the mark of the beast, and the truth about God's chosen people, and so much more about Bible prophecy. This book will shatter the left-behind paradigm of future events. Get the book, The Rapture Will Be Canceled. Visit CrossTheBorder.org, C-R-O-S-S, CrossTheBorder.org, to get your print, EPUB, or PDF version of the book, The Rapture Will Be Canceled. That's CrossTheBorder.org.
Since the beginning of time, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it, it has been traded, it has been borrowed, it has been purchased, it has been stolen, there's a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty, to ourselves and to our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188 or visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, right here on FirstAmendmentRadio.com at 4 p.m. Eastern or 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, 1-800-375-4188.
Oh, sorry. Welcome back. You're listening to Cross the Border. It's our Prophecy Reality Edition. Got to remember where I was now. Ah, yes. Famine. We're talking about that. Famine. A famine of the cheap articles of food, whether literally taken or metaphorically. Well, picking back up here with E.B. Eliot's explanation of why the black horse and the balances don't represent famine. I think that comes with the next horse, you know, the pale horse with death riding. You can see the distinct difference between a black horse with balances and a pale one with death. So anyway, we're talking about the black horse with the balances. Okay. First, the coinix, yeah. And we talked about the coin. Okay, I must have backed up some. Where was I? Okay, this is where I'll pick up. But then admitting the Attic coinex to be the one meant the prefiguration, how far would the second supposition of the expositors referred to be borne out? That is to say that the prices of a coinex of wheat and barley named as from the throne were famine prices, such as to make all faces gather blackness. Of course, the average prices is near about the time of Domitian and St. John's exile in Patmos, not those of quite another times, must be the standard of reference. That would make sense. And judging by what the elder Pliny reports of prices not very long before, we shall find that though the price of wheat here named might be a scarcity price, it could hardly be called one of famine. Then, moreover, what of the very singular added specification of the price of barley? Three coinixes of barley, that is that would be quartz. For a denarius, surely this is one such as to put the idea of famine altogether out of the question. For to the state of argument in its simplest form, for as much as the Attic coinage was proverbially the day's sufficient quota for a man of wheat or barley, and at the same time a denarius was approximately the daily wages of labor in St. John's time, the price specified would indicate that a laboring man would gain under this seal's nearly 3 days' sufficiency of barley bread, above 5 pound in weight, by 1 day's labor. Did ever a man hear of such a famine as this? Thus, even were no other difficulty to oppose it, yet would the famine hypothesis break down utterly on this one single account. But in fact, beside this, all else in the figuration, except indeed the black color of the horse, is opposed to it. One, the injunction of the rider, see that thou injure not, or that thou act not unjustly about the oil and the wine. Those two other next most important articles of culture and consumption in the Roman world, an injunction of which the spirit, whichever translation be taken, was directly opposed to the idea of its being the main object in the voice from which, from the throne, to enjoin or to proclaim a famine. Two, the circumstance of it being a conjunctive, not disjunctive, which connects this latter clause of the charge to the writer about the oil and the wine with that of the charge of the former about the barley, the wheat and barley, constitutes of itself a strong argument in favor of the former being of a similarly kindly purport of the latter. Moreover, third, the balance in the writer's hand associated, as it is, not with man's weighing out bits of bread in scanty measure for his own or his family's eating, I pray the reader to mark this, so as in the oft misapplied passage from Ezekiel 4:10 and 16, but in association with the buying and selling of corn. I say in this association, the balance, instead of being an indication of famine, might just as well be an indication of plenty, seeing that at all times corn and bread were sold by weight or measure. In fact, in the Roman Baker Monument outside the Porta Maggiore at Rome, among the various implements of his trade, there sculpted a pair of balances as one. Was this, then, altogether a fit symbol for famine? Surely a more unfit one could scarce have been devised. The idea of famine thus decisively set aside, we are forced to seek for some other and quite different solution, such as may better suit the conditions of the case. And in order to this, with reference to two very important particulars of those conditions, it needs now that we conclude first as to the right construction of the latter clause in the voice as from the throne, whether in the sense of injure not or wrong not in regard to the oil of, and the wine, kind of mean the same thing, in reference to the balance depicted as in the hand of the writer, what might have been its most usual meaning as a symbol at the time of the vision. Now as to the Greek clause, the admissibility of the latter translation is suggested, as well as the former, results clearly and necessarily, as it seems to me, from these two undisputed, indisputable facts. One, that it is a neutral intransitive verb, as well as a verb transitive and active. The other, that in the case of the intransitive neutral verbs, generally, there's frequently appended to them an accusative of definition. Boy, we're getting into some heavy stuff here as far as, and I'm not sure I'm getting it myself, but I've read it many times, or at least three or four times already, and I get the general idea. that this is not pointing to a famine, but it is pointing to something else. So I'm going to move up here a little bit and see if we can get to the point. And I guess the point is this, after all the complicated detail. And now then, our analysis of the several parts of the symbol being completed, proceed we in search of a solution as may satisfy them all. Whose or what the agency, we have to ask, in the Roman Empire was symbolized by the balance holding rider. Yeah, isn't that what we want to know? And I, you know, this is part of the problem with most people is reading something like the Hoary Apocalypticae. Could you imagine having to read that three or four times and sometimes still getting bogged down in the details? Yeah. But he does get to it. Whose or what the voice admonishing him as from the throne? And wherefore, in such terms about the price of corn and against injustice in the matter of wine and oil? How, though, holding the balance of justice, his influence such in aggravation of the other previous evil as to deepen the sanguine red of the Roman aspect into the darker blackness of distress? Finally, what in the main intent of the hieroglyphic as a whole, and how designative, as it seemed presumable, of some notable cause of further suffering and decline introduced into the Roman body politic, of suffering introduced at a time following that of the establishment of military misrule, with its concomitants of civil war and bloodshed, so as under the second seal, and preceding that of the pestilence and mortality, which we shall soon see attached to the fourth, that it would be the one coming up. This, I say, is the question. And, you know, that is the question. And most people reading this don't understand what the questions are, and they simply go on with their imagination and attach it to whatever they imagine it might be, according to the news in the newspaper or something. That's what the futurists do, or whatever they imagine the future might be. But he gets to what are the true questions? What do these things mean? He says, I say this is the question. And though to ourselves for the present it may be obscure and enigmatic, and from want of familiarity with Roman symbols and usages, which may not improbably have made the figuration at once clear to the evangelist as a contemporary, yet on looking for light into history, and especially to that same philosophic and picturesque history of the Roman Empire, which has already so admirably illustrated the subjects of our first and second seals, the clue, if I mistake not, will be found. The solution will appear. On consulting Gibbon, then, we find, towards the close of his sketch of the reign of Alexander Severus, referring to the aggravated oppressiveness of the taxation consequent on a memorable edict of the preceding empire of Caracalla, an edict which had to be enforced by the provincial governors as a fresh and wasting evil then introduced into the body politic, it is after a retrospective glance at the primary cause of the empire's decline, which I suppose to have been pictured in the symbolization of the second seal, I mean the pure military despotism of the soldiery and the sword, that he takes it up for notice, and as if another influential cause of the decline of the empire, and deems it of importance such as to call for a long digression on the subject of Roman taxation to which it relates, let me briefly abstract his statement. In the original constitution by the then Roman Republic of its conquered provinces, it seems that tributes more or less onerous were imposed on them, which tributes after the conquest of Greece and Syria had become so productive as to suffice to pay all the expenses of the government and to allow the entire exemption of Roman citizens from all taxes. This exemption, however, continued only to the time of Augustus, who soon after his establishment of the empire declared the necessities of their again bearing a share also of public burdens. Thus, henceforward, the provincials had their distinctive taxes to pay, and the Roman citizens, among whom all Italians were now included, theirs, the latter consisting of customs, duties, and excises, taxes the more oppressive from the constant and pernicious habit of farming them, and the tax of 1/20 on legacies and inheritance, the former either of tributes of produce in kind or money capitation tax. During the era of Trajan and Antoninus, as given, the mildness and precision of laws asserting the rule and measure of taxation and protecting the subjects of every rank against arbitrary interpretations, antiquated claims, and the insolent vexation of the farmers of the revenue alleviated the burdens, though they did not remove them, but some 30-40 years after the death of Antonine, and while the rider of the Red Horse and civil wars were yet in full career, they received, insofar as the provincials were concerned, a sudden aggravation. The Emperor Caracalla issued the memorial edict with which his name is associated, by which the Roman city was made coextensive with the empire, an edict of not of liberality, which might at first have been imagined, but simply of avarice, for it was clogged with the condition that the provincials, thus admitted to Roman citizenship, should thenceforth pay both their provincial tributes as before, and also in addition the distinctive taxes now augmented, of the Roman citizen. The edict was compulsory, and the weight of taxation thus forced upon them intolerable. And you see this play out in history. I think it's playing out in our history right now. Yeah. Taxes are going up and up and up, whereas before we had it pretty easy in the land where I live. So what follows after this era? This is like the era that we're in right now, in the good old US of A, where the taxes are being piled on and on, because all of the advantages that America had that came with the introduction of the Antichrist's first world reserve currency, that is the Federal Reserve note. Could say now all of our chickens are coming home to roost, and now we got to pay our own way. Yeah. And we're all running out of money for some reason. Imagine that. But you get the idea that this is the weight of taxation now becoming heavy upon the people, and everything being measured out exactly and overbearingly by this black horse with a measure, and everything is being measured, and a measure being added to everything that we do. Every time you turn around and spend a dollar, the government is getting an overbearing cut. You know, hey, that's what comes with socialism, you know. Some countries are paying 80% of their wages in taxes. Wouldn't you call that? Yeah, I think that's the kind of thing that's being depicted here. And E.B. Eliot has convinced me of his argument that this era fits precisely the next era is the famine. And I guess that's the one we're going to cover next time when we come back. We'll move into the fourth seal and the horse, the pale horse, and the name of him that sat on him was death, and hell followed with him, because that's where famine really leads, to death. Yeah, that's what famine is all about. So famine, not with this horse and this seal, but it's the one that follows. Okay. Well, you're listening to Across the Border, our Prophecy Reality Edition, and this is our continuation into our apocalyptic inquiry. And I'm just giving you an overview and using Gibbon, of course. Gibbon was Well, he was not a Christian man. And many people would think if he was a Christian, he would have wrote. It seems like he wrote his history of the Roman Empire to complement the Revelation. And perhaps, you know, in the great scheme of things, that he was destined to do this. But he was a heathen. He was an unbeliever. He was an unregenerate man. He was not the friend of Christians, though in his history he was honest. Yeah. And his history corresponds. So we have this one great historian who wrote this book. And of course, he pulls from other histories, just as E.B. Eliot does, checking all the references, getting into each era of the Roman Empire, because this is the rise and fall, you know, Gibbon's fall of the Roman Empire. Of course, you have to talk about what it fell from. And so he starts with his history right about the time of the commencement of the Revelation and the things which must shortly come to pass. Isn't that amazing? You'd think all that the Almighty might have had his hand in the whole thing. It seems evident to me that he did, yes. But this is something that the futurists and people that prognosticate and believe in future speculation as their rock. You know, my rock of prophecy is future speculation. Why, our speculation is true, and if you don't believe our speculation, you're worse than a heretic. And boy, they kick them out of churches if they don't believe in their future speculation. Many a pastor who has walked away from futurism has been kicked out of his church. Can you believe that? Their entire denominations where they kick you out, like the Calvary Chapel. Boy, you start preaching historicism and you don't go with the rapture doctrines and the future Antichrist and the 7-year tribulation deception, bam, you're out. You know, no toleration whatsoever. If you're not preaching, and I'm going to put it plainly, if you're not preaching counter-reformation, futurist dispensational eschatology that vindicates the papacy and the great apostasy, you know, that is the Roman Catholic Church, a great apostasy and the seat of the papacy from being the man of sin, the depicted Antichrist of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Yeah, you're vindicating the true Antichrist and the greatest apostasy that has ever landed on the face of the planet, okay? It rose up, and it was the greatest then, and it has continued as it should be, as the prophecy says. This great apostasy is still the greatest apostasy in existence today, claiming nearly 2 billion adherents on the face of the earth, and embracing every other pagan atrocity and apostasy within its fold today. Yes, asking Saint Francis, the most holy father, Antichrist Francis, why he embraces every other religion and belief on the face of the planet. Well, you've been listening to our Prophecy Reality Edition. May the Almighty bless you and keep you as you walk on the narrow way that leads to life.
Visit crosstheborder.org, C-R-O-S-S, crosstheborder.org, to get your print, EPUB, or PDF version of Nicholas Arthur's new book titled, When the Third Temple is Built. That's crosstheborder.org. When it comes to prophecy today, much of the evangelical Christian world